Well, that is the Trenchies Talk Show, so you know what time it is. It's time for Psychobabble. Psychobabble is a show every week on Fridays at 12 noon where we try to address a wide array of issues concerning mental health and well-being, both micro and macro. My name is Ed, and all the opinions you're going to hear in the next hour or so are strictly those of my guest today and myself and do not represent those of the station. If you're having any kind of mental health crisis, there's a great resource. It's basically 911 for mental health. It's 988. That's 988. It's a suicide hotline. You can both text or call either one. And also remember that listening to the show does not substitute for actual treatment or therapy. It's just for information purposes only. Having said all that, I am very, very happy and excited to have my guest. This is a friend of mine who I've met through my work and just a unique individual. His name is Woody Lucas, or Woodrow Lucas, I should say. I'm going to have you kind of talk about yourself for a second, okay? You got to get right up on the mic for me. There you go. Introduce yourself, Woody.
Hi, Ed. It's great to see you again. My name is Woodrow Lucas, but I go by Woody. You can call me Wood. You can call me Woody Woodpecker. It's up to you.
Okay.
I am a 49-year-old man. I've had a pretty successful professional career. I have two children, 25 and 15, Autumn and Gabby, who I absolutely adore.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder since 2001. In 2001, I had a psychotic break, and they diagnosed me with schizoaffective disorder, and I've been on meds ever since. And I guess my philosophy with that, being an ardent Christian and being an ardent believer in God and Jesus Christ, was that I would not allow this illness to rob me of a full life. And that has been the philosophy that I've lived by since 2001, that this illness will not rob me of a full life.
Woody, could you educate people about what exactly schizoaffective disorder is? I think it's a diagnosis most people who are just listening to us might not be very familiar with.
I think that's a good question, Ed. Schizoaffective, in the most layman's terms I could possibly think of, is that it's a less severe form of schizophrenia. And it's a variant of bipolar 2.
Mm.
So it's got mood swings as part of the symptoms. It's got psychosis as part of the symptoms. It's got there are different variants of it. There's depressive schizoaffective, and then there's bipolar mood swing schizoaffective. But the thing that's unique about schizoaffective is that it's not just mood swings or psychosis when you're manic. It's paranoia, psychosis, and kind of delusional orientations at times, whether you're manic or not. And then it's also the mood swings that people with bipolar experience as well.
Mm.
But it's important to note that schizoaffective, in my opinion at least, is not as severe an illness as schizophrenia. Mm. It's like getting COVID versus the flu.
Okay.
You know, COVID is, you don't want COVID, but the flu is similar, but it's not as bad.
Gotcha. All right. That's an interesting comparison. You have been diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder since 2001. Is that right? 2001.
Yes.
So that's 23 years. Can you... What, you know, if someone is wondering, I mean, about the emerging symptoms one would have, do you remember, like, going back to 2000, 2001, what was beginning to go on with you that you felt like, oh, I need to go get some help?
Well, I started having emerging symptoms, Ed, in, like, 1999.
Mm.
And I was a charismatic Christian back then.
Mm-hmm.
I still have charismatic, even though I'm a member of a Lutheran church right now, I still have charismatic aspects to everything I do. But it's very deceptive when you're a charismatic Christian because, you know, there are a lot of bells and whistles that go with being a charismatic Christian. And so I started to hear voices, and I thought they were angels. You know, I mean, I don't think that was an idiotic thing to think. Mm-hmm. It was consistent with what I was being taught, and it was consistent with what I was reading in Scripture.
Yeah.
So I thought that I was hearing angels, and I was in the beginnings of psychosis. You know, and it came to a head when I listened to a voice telling me to go to a place called the Pacific Garden Mission, mm-hmm. which was a good mission, but it was definitely not a place for somebody who was beginning to have mental health issues.
Right.
It was not that kind of environment.
Right.
So that exacerbated things for me. And then I moved from Chicago down to Omaha, Nebraska to be closer to my parents. And I was working at a place called CSG Systems. And I got frustrated because I could not find my thoughts. Mm. One of the symptoms of severe and persistent mental illness is that sometimes you'll lose your train of thought and you won't be able to pick it back up. And I was in the middle of a technical call and I lost my train of thought and I got frustrated and I quit the job. Mm-hmm. And that was enough of a shock to my system to cause me to go into a psychotic break.
Wow. Okay.
And I was in a psychotic break for 10 days. And if it wasn't for my ex-wife, who I still think is just a wonderful person, if it wasn't for my ex-wife now, my wife at the time, tricking me to go to Emmanuel Hospital,
right.
I don't know what would have happened.
That's what it took.
But she said that, she told me that Emmanuel Hospital was purgatory,
uh-huh.
and that I needed to go there. And I said, okay, I'll go.
So she knew how to speak your language.
Well, I think that she intuitively, because she loved me so much, knew how to deal with people who are in a state of delusion. You step into the delusion with them, and you meet them subjectively where they are, and you talk to them where they are.
As opposed to trying to argue them out of their delusion.
Exactly. As opposed to trying to use logic and reason to argue right. and say, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't make sense.
Woody, does schizoaffective disorder, is it more prevalent in family? Is it genetically connected at all? Or is it a completely random occurrence? Do you know?
I believe that all mental illness has genetic components. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's an old National Alliance of Mental Illness saying that says that that genetics is the gun, but trauma pulls the trigger.
Right. Okay.
You know, and that's it's a little oversimplified, but it's a good metaphor.
No, that's good.
So I think that I come from a family on my dad's side where many people have mental illness, and many people have severe and persistent mental illness, and so I think that there's definitely a genetic component to it.
Right. So. That's a really good point about the genetics plus the trauma, right? Because if you have a life where you might have a predilection, I'm looking for a word there, towards mental illness, but if your life is, I don't know, trauma-free. I'm not sure whose life is trauma-free, but if your life is trauma-free and smooth sailing and everything's fine, maybe you never experience those symptoms. Is that what you're saying?
I believe that wholeheartedly, yeah. And I think that my two daughters are examples of that.
Mm.
You know, when my ex-wife and I got a divorce, it was one of the hardest things I've ever experienced, not because she was negative or because she was brutal or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
but because I felt like I was losing my right hand. You know? Right. I felt like I was losing the person that I tested reality with and did mm-hmm. those kinds of things with.
Yeah.
And I got partial custody of my children. And one of the things that I focused on was I said, I cannot exhibit behavior in their presence
mm-hmm.
that traumatizes them or that triggers them or that gives them an example of behavior that's abnormal. So I forced myself to really be as normal in quotes, because what is normal, but
right.
to really be as normal as I could around them, so that if they had genetic predilection themselves, it wouldn't manifest. And in both cases, they're happy, healthy, whole, well, and well-adjusted. And that's always my prayer for them.
That's awesome. So your children and even your ex-wife kind of inspired you, motivated you, let's say, to really do what you needed to do to take care of yourself.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes my self-care was very bad physically,
mm-hmm.
But my self-care is always extremely good emotionally and mentally.
Right.
I'm always talking to myself. I'm always talking myself up. I'm always encouraging myself. Mm-hmm. I'm always emotionally giving myself that latitude to feel certain emotions. Physically, I get better and better at the ADLs. You know, I get better and better at physically taking care of myself. But mentally and emotionally, that self-care has always been a big component.
You just said the term ADLs. A lot of people don't know what that means. What are you talking about, ADLs?
ADLs are activities of daily living, mm-hmm. Ed. And activities of daily living are very powerful. They're like taking a shower every day, brushing your teeth every day, mm-hmm. exercising every day, mm-hmm. making your bed every day. And unfortunately, in a lot of facilities, they're forced on people.
Right.
And it's unfortunate because if you force something on someone, they're going to rebel and they're not going to do it.
Exactly.
But if they're communicated the right way, what you see about activities of daily living is that they help you to love yourself existentially, mm-hmm. physically.
Because it's the act of love of yourself, right?
Exactly.
Taking care of yourself, hygiene, making up your bed, you know, keeping your space relatively clean. That's how you show that you are valuing yourself.
Is that's one of the ways that you show that you're valuing yourself. Exactly. Yes. That it's that physical, concrete way that really speaks to your inner child and that really speaks to certain aspects of your consciousness.
Right.
And so it has much more of a positive effect than it seems when you're just kind of going through the motions doing it.
Right. We're going to take a music break, as I do with all our guests. I've asked Woody to identify a couple songs that he thought might be good for our show today. And the first song we're going to play that Woody suggested is a song I love as well, D'Lai Soul, Me, Myself, and I. Why'd you pick this song, Woody?
When I was 15 years old, this was my anthem.
All right. This is D'Lai Soul. You can't go wrong. Listen up.
For me, myself, and I. They diss my person by stating I'm darkly packed. I know this, so I point at Q-Tip and he states,
black is black.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, shovel chestnuts in my path. Just keep all nuts with the nuts so I don't get an aftermath. But if I do, I'll calmly punch them in the fourth day of July. Cause they try to mess with third degree, that's me, myself, and I. Myself and I.
just me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I.
One and only De La Soul with Me, Myself, and I. Support for WXAA comes from the Special Olympics, providing year-round health screenings, sports training, and athletic competition in a variety of Olympic-type sports for children and adults with intellectual disabilities. The Special Olympics goal is to develop and demonstrate fitness and courage by sharing gifts, skills, and friendship through the joy of sport. More information at SpecialOlympicsTN.org. If you're just joining us, we are here in the studio with Woody Lucas, who is a friend of mine, and who is also someone who's been diagnosed with a as Woody termed it, a severe and persistent mental illness. In this case, schizoaffective disorder. And Woody was telling us what that means, what some of the symptoms are, and you've been in treatment for that since 2001. Is that right?
That's right, Ed.
How long after you got diagnosed, after you had that first crisis, how long before you began to feel a sense of stability, like you could get back into your life? If you remember, maybe you don't remember, but...
Well, you know, Ed, it was very nonlinear. My recovery has always been a nonlinear process, where I feel like God has taken certain aspects and advanced them.
Mm-hmm.
God has put certain aspects on the shelf to be dealt with later. And it's just been a very nonlinear process where I've had to be flexible and just advance when I could advance and in the ways that I could advance. So when I first got diagnosed with schizoaffective, my wife, ex-wife now, but wife at that time, her father shot himself. Mm. And it was very traumatic for me because I really loved the man. And here I was diagnosed with schizoaffective, barely functional, and I had to go to his funeral, and I had to, preside as a minister. I was a licensed minister at the time.
Mm.
And I had to, represent for what I felt about him and who he was, you know. And I think it was ironic because I think that what he struggled with may not have been a severe and persistent mental illness, but it was a type of illness. It was a type of emotional illness. So it just shows you how important mental health is and how important mental health education is and how important mental health intervention is, because everybody on this earth has some kind of pain.
Mm.
And that's the essence of part of mental illness. Mental illness, in my opinion, is both a gift and a source of or a function of pain. And you can either focus on the gift side or the pain side or both, but you need people when you have mental illness. Now,
talk more about that, Woody. You need people. How do you mean?
Well, you know, it's like no one on this earth is an island.
Mm.
And recovery functions better when you're receiving love. In my opinion, love is the solution to recovery. I mean, if you listen to scientists talk, they'll say there's no cure for mental illness. I disagree with them, and I'll say that love is the cure for mental illness. If you pour enough love into somebody, and you focus on love, and you enact love in concrete ways like care and medication and therapy and coping mechanisms and encouragement and affirmation and just walking alongside people and giving them the ministry of presence. If you love somebody enough, they will experience progress in their recovery.
You know, it's so true that a lot of folks with severe and persistent mental illness do find themselves isolated and isolating, pulling away from the people who love them, pulling away from, you know, all the support systems. So I couldn't agree with you more that you need people and love to be successful in your recovery. Can you tell us some of the ways that you have cultivated that community of people over the years?
Well, I'll tell you, Ed, you know, it's like a lot of times it was just given to me. I mean, I cannot stress enough how helpful my parents, my brother, my ex-wife, and my children have been in my recovery process. I mean, I feel like all of them have been blessed with a lot of love and compassion. And I feel like my ex-wife and my two kids have extremely high emotional intelligence, as is my older brother. And this kind of tribe of network, this kind of support network of people, you know, they're like a soccer team. One is a striker, one is the left halfback, one is the right halfback, one is the center halfback. So when my parents have really been a practical source of inspiration and assistance. Like when I was in grad school, they were always encouraging me to study and, you know, not let the illness hold me back.
Right.
My ex-wife has always been a reflective source of encouragement and affirmation, saying, well, remember, you know, this is what's going on and you are wonderfully made and you've done amazing things. And then my kids, just in admiring me and just in adoring me the way they do, remind me of how valuable and important I am. To be honest with you, Ed, there have been times in this mental health journey, and I'm sure most people with severe and persistent mental illness have experienced this, where I have considered suicide. I mean, suicide has been something that I was considering. And every single time that I have considered suicide, my kids pop into my mind.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I can't do that to them. I'm like, I can't do that to them. That's the only thing that pops in my mind. I'm like, they need me. They need me whether I'm sick or whether I'm healthy. They need me.
I guess you were also, I mean, and you can look at this as a blessing or however you would want to look at it, but it was awesome that you had people in your lives who didn't abandon you because you had a mental illness, because that happens quite a bit.
That happens a lot.
So you have loving parents. You have even though you're divorced, you have a loving ex-wife. You have loving children. You also have friends, and you have, and you've taken, you know, you've sought out treatment. So you've gotten help from professionals, from psychiatrists, from therapists and whatnot, correct?
Correct. And I'll tell you, Ed, I remember I've always tried to work. I've always tried to be engaged in some kind of income earning activity. And I started working just 6 months after being diagnosed with schizoaffective. And the reason for that was that I just could tell that the work was stressful and it was not enjoyable at all, but it kept me from sinking into some kind of like molasses of consciousness. You know, it kept me from the quicksand, you know, because I had to perform.
Yeah.
There was a certain accountability that I had to be true to. Right. So, you know, that aspect has given me a social dimension of accountability that's been helpful. But I had these two. I had a Christian counselor, and I had a traditional psychologist. And they said, well, you're not really supposed to have two counselors at the same time. I said, I really don't care. I said, I'm having two counselors at the same time because I need one of you guys to be liberal with, and I need one of you guys to be conservative with, and I'm a hybrid. So yeah. either you take me on or you don't, and so. I had a Christian counselor, and I had a very excellent psychologist, and the two of them together tag teamed me. You know, my psychiatrist was kind of absent he was kind of a hospital psychiatrist. He was kind of absent.
He just managed the medicine.
He just kind of gave me the meds, and that was about it. I never really talked to him.
What kind of parenthetically, what kind of meds did you get on in the beginning of your treatment? Do you remember even what
those meds were? Depakote. Yeah. I got on Depakote. I think I got on a Depakote, Abilify,
maybe some kind of antidepressant.
Depakote, Abilify, no antidepressant. I've never been on an antidepressant.
Oh, interesting.
Depakote, Abilify, and a sleep medication. I forget what the sleep medication was. I've been on Ambien CR for a long time.
I mean, and you've been on meds of one sort or another since you started treatment.
Yeah, I've been on meds of one sort or another since I started treatment. except for a period of time where I tried to get off meds with a non-traditional psychiatrist. So it wasn't an irresponsible move.
Right.
But I tried to get off meds with a non-traditional psychiatrist. That was disastrous.
I don't blame you for trying, but it just didn't work out.
It didn't work out. And so I said, well, the meds are, they're pretty helpful. So
yeah, yeah.
I'm going to stay with them.
And so you're, even to this day, you see a psychiatrist on a regular basis and you see a therapist on a regular
basis. I love my psychiatrist, and I'll name them my name because I don't have to go by HIPAA with them.
No.
They have to go by HIPAA with me, but I don't have to go by HIPAA with them.
You can advertise.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Hey, this person's great.
One is Dr. Ching, and this guy is an answer to prayer. He's so. Dr. Ching. He's got alternative medicine aspects to how he does his psychiatry. He's very open-minded, and he gives me credit for knowing what I'm doing.
So like you, he's a hybrid.
He's a hybrid. Yep. he doesn't treat me like a child, which I really appreciate.
Yeah.
And then I've got an amazing therapist, Maria Andrushenko.
She's been a guest on this show before.
Yeah, she is absolutely fantastic. And we have a great rapport. She's who introduced me to you.
Right.
So she is fantastic. And I've really always been blessed with amazing therapists, with good therapists who really have modeled that whole Rogerian, positive regard,
client-centered
aspect.
Absolutely. We're going to take another music break, and we're going to come back and talk about something I know Woody wants to talk about deeply, which is his spiritual practices and how those have really been helpful to him coping, not just coping, but sometimes really thriving. And a particular model he wants to talk about as well that he invented, actually. So stay tuned for that. Before we go away for this music break, as always, I'm going to ask Woody, you want me to play Stevie Wonder, Sir Duke, which is, of course, a classic. But why this song? Just because you love it? Or is there something about it that speaks to you today?
Well, Duke Ellington was a beast, man. And he was a beast in a time where it was hard to be a black man and be a beast.
Yeah.
And he was able to cross over, and he was able to become an icon in society, similar to Paul Robeson, during the Jim Crow era.
Right.
And for that reason, I just adore him. And then I adore Stevie Wonder because I feel like he's got such insight as an artist.
Right.
And for him to create a tribute song to Sir Duke.
Yeah.
I just think is an example of African Americans passing the love forward.
Also, I wonder how many people discovered Duke Ellington through this song. It's like he introduced people even to who Duke Ellington was. So I think it's great. Anyway, this is Stevie Wonder with Sir Duke. Enjoy.
There's no way the band could lose. You can feel it all over.
All right, I'm going to turn down the Stevie for a little bit so I can do my PSA and we can get back to speaking with Woody. The programming you hear on WXNA is made by people just like you. This station is completely homegrown, featuring nearly 80 DJs from the community bringing their unique voices and tastes to the airwaves. And it's all supported by friends and neighbors whose generosity keeps WXNA going. That's what community radio is all about, and all of us need to chip in for it to work. Do your part and donate now to WXNAFM.org. Okay, well, let's return to our chat here between Woody and I. We've been talking about Woody's a couple decades now of coping with a very serious mental illness called schizoaffective disorder. And we were just talking about various ways Woody has been coping. What's most important is he has felt connected to a community, especially his family, friends, his own children. He's also done his best as a professional person to stay engaged with work. I was going to go right in and talk about Woody's spiritual practices, but before I do that, Woody, I wanted to ask you about your grad school. You mentioned it. What kind of grad school did you go to? What did you get trained in grad school?
Yeah, in grad school, I went to Vanderbilt, and I got an MTS, which is a Master's in Theological Studies, and I got an MBA, which is a Master's in Business Administration. And so those were the two. And then when I graduated from getting those two master's degrees, I went into a PhD program at Vanderbilt in Organizational Studies and Behavior, and I was in that PhD program for 3 years, but I needed to take another medical leave just because with the nature of the illness, it comes episodically.
Yes.
And so I needed to take another medical leave, and to be honest, I just had too much pride taking another medical leave, so I left the program. And it's a big regret of mine because I love the PhD program and I like teaching.
Yeah, but you have two masters, and I know you and I have talked about this. You're thinking about getting back into higher education, but that's very impressive. And so one of those masters was the theological master at Vanderbilt, and I know your own spiritual Christian practices are essential to your coping and to your really connecting and making meaning out of your life. Could you just tell people your journey through your spiritual life, because you've kind of had a trip from one form of certain kind of outlook when it comes to your Christian beliefs to something different?
Yeah, well, I was brought up Episcopalian and didn't really appreciate it. You know, I think that the liturgical mainstream Christian religions are epic and a beautiful religions. And their focus on the Eucharist is absolutely fantastic. But a lot of times, young people don't appreciate it because there's no bells and whistles, really, to grasp onto. And you're kind of like, what am I doing? I'm just going through the motions and the Book of Common Prayer. And
right.
So when I graduated from college, I joined a Baptist church, and I started getting very heavily into Pentecostal and charismatic orientations. And I experienced
which is really the polar opposite of Episcopals.
Exactly. Which is what some people call the born again experience, or the awakening, whatever you want to call it. I experienced that, but I also experienced exposure to something that I had not been taught as an Episcopalian, and thankfully so. Really, in retrospect, I was introduced to the doctrine of eternal hell. Which is a doctrine that if you don't confess Jesus Christ before death, you go to eternal hell, and you live in eternal conscious torment for your entire existence, and that
which is eternity.
It was eternity, exactly, and so that really traumatized me as I was receiving that truth and believing that truth. To be honest with you, Ed, I think that was a really gun firing trigger that triggered my genetic disposition towards severe and persistent mental illness. I was so tormented by the idea of people burning in hell forever.
Right.
I was on buses and trains preaching to people, asking them to believe in Jesus. Everywhere I went, I would ask people, "Do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe in Jesus? Do you believe in Jesus?"
Just because you didn't want them to burn.
Because I didn't want them to burn hell forever, and it really decimated the meaning of life for me. I was like, "Well, if if everyone who doesn't confess Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior burns in hell forever, what is the meaning of life at all? Right. You're just here to believe in Jesus Christ and then go to heaven because everything else has no meaning. It's like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. So, and after getting diagnosed with schizoaffective in 2001, I was searching the scriptures. In 2002, about a year and a half later, after my diagnosis, and I was searching the scriptures, and I just started finding scriptures that that suggested something radically different than this eternal hell doctrine that I had been exposed to and that I had invested myself in. Mm-hmm. And these scriptures were scriptures like John 12:32. If I be lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men unto me. Like 1 Corinthians 1:17, that Jesus Christ is reconciling all things to himself. Like Ephesians, that talks about this, Jesus Christ, the Savior of all men, especially those that believe. Scriptures like this started standing out to me, and I was like, what am I seeing? What am I seeing? What am I seeing? And I remembered an encounter that I had back when I was a very zealous minister in 1999, with a man who was homeless and also was also an alcoholic. And he said something to me that I'll never forget. He said, hell is just a disinfecting place. It does not last forever. And I remember feeling the chills all over my body when I heard him say this, but I couldn't receive it at the time. I was too locked into the whole eternal hell rhetoric and everything. Mm-hmm. And so from 2002 forward, I've been what's called the Christian Universalist. Mm. And of course, God always gives you what you need when you need it. That was at the same time that I became a Christian Universalist was the same time that the famous charismatic leader Carlton Pearson also became a Christian Universalist. He called it the doctrine of inclusion, but it's basically Christian Universalism. Mm-hmm. And
we'll define that really quickly, to Christian Universalism.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Christian Universalism is the idea that when Jesus Christ died on the cross, his victory over the devil, evil, and sin was absolute and was an absolute victory. So that really we're not, it's not as if he died and then we've got to do something. He died and he purchased every soul in creation. And he's reconciling those souls to love. So he died, and that's it. It's over. It's a done deal. The mm-hmm. victory is already been achieved. And so what a lot of us receiving Christ is us coming to an awareness and an awakening to the beneficence of what he's already done for us, rather than us and our own power repenting and doing something to earn eternal salvation. So Universalism says that it says basically three basic doctrines. Number one, God is love. Number two, Jesus Christ is Lord and Savior. And number three, everyone everywhere eventually gets a happy ending.
That's awesome. That's a much better I like that set of beliefs rather than the burn in hell belief, right? Right on. And that notion, that realization really helped you in your own healing.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, there would be times when I would just be hopeless. Mm. I would be totally hopeless. I would just feel like, this is impossible, man. I cannot get this done. And I would remember, I would be like, you know what? There are people who don't have toothpaste and their teeth are rotting. And those people and me share the same destiny. Mm. And we're going to end up in the same place or in the same place of consciousness or whatever, however you want to view it. But we're both equal. We're all equally loved by God. And God is not going to leave anyone behind. And when I think of a God like that, when I think of a God that really will leave a 99 to go after that one lost sheep and will grab that one lost sheep and tell that one lost sheep, I love you unconditionally, it always lifts me out of despair and discouragement.
You are a true hybrid because you still have some of the practices of a more charismatic, you know, sensibility, correct?
Yep.
And you also embrace universal salvation, which is what we're talking about right now, this idea that everyone was saved by Jesus, not just, you know, not just Church of Christ people.
Yeah.
No offense, Church of Christ people, but it, basically everyone. Everyone is
yeah, everybody everywhere. Hindu,
everyone
Buddhist,
is equal
Jewish,
to Jesus.
Agnostic, atheist.
Yes, right.
Jesus got them all.
Right.
Awesome. And you know, and I'll tell you, Ed, I'm still a hybrid because I currently attend Christ Lutheran Church of Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
So I currently attend a mainline Lutheran church. Although my identity is still Christian Universalism deep
is
down.
Is there a Christian Universalist church?
There aren't that many Christian Universalist churches. There was one called House of the Lord, mm-hmm. pastored by Bob and Charlotte Tarango, but they're very elderly now, so that church doesn't really operate in the same way as it used to.
It just seems like that message would be so appealing.
I'll tell you, Ed. I mean, I try to spread it whenever I can. I try to support it because I really think that it has the power to bring the world together. This idea that Jesus Christ did not come to bring us an ultimatum. He didn't come to threaten us. He came to reflect a loving God with a plan of salvation for every living creature.
That's awesome. Can you... before we go to the next music break and kind of sum up the show a little bit, can you tell us about your model that you use, that you kind of came up with as far as a help?
Oh, the Raven technique.
And what is this technique to help with? What does it help with?
Yeah, the Raven technique is basically, you know, in Eastern religion, they have mantras.
Mm-hmm.
And then in old Christian religion, they have chants.
Mm-hmm.
And both of these mantras and chants are based on repetition.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Raven technique does is it bases things in forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically you repeat phrases of forgiveness over and over and over and over and over again. And what it does is it increases your awareness of your own forgiveness. And it really existentially frees people from things that they struggle with. Because forgiveness is just that powerful.
Now, is this a technique you would use when you're struggling with lots of negative self-thinking? Or, you know,
this is a technique when I use, Ed, when I can't connect to God.
Mm.
Like, there are times when you're just so up under it that you can't get in that state of meditative prayer, or you can't meditate because your thoughts are all over the place. But you can say a phrase over and over again in your mind.
Yeah.
You can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I use this in those times. And I also use this to keep myself vibrant because with schizoaffective schizophrenia, those two illnesses, there's sometimes an inertia into a kind of malaise.
Mm-hmm.
And the Raven technique keeps me lucid,
mm-hmm.
and keeps my mind and keeps my brain active when it may otherwise sink into a malaise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That sounds great. So you want to tell people what it is?
Yeah, the Raven technique.
Yeah.
It's called the Raven technique. And if you want to get information on it, on my YouTube channel, Woodrow Lucas, Christ Universal Ministries, I've got a video on the Raven technique. And then on my business website, www.empoweredrecoveryconsulting.com, I've got a free PDF that you can download called the Raven Technique. I never want anyone to pay for this technique because you don't pay for spiritual stuff, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a free download that you get on my company website. And those are the two places where it's available. And both the video and the PDF explain the Raven Technique in detail. And it's really a great way to progress when you feel stuck in your recovery. It's really a great way to progress.
Mm-hmm. And, okay. And so they can look that up. They can find you online. And you just told them where. That's awesome. Do you want to outline it right now for our audience?
Yeah, I will define a Raven technique phrase. Okay. I will define a Raven technique word.
Yeah.
And then I will say that word over and over again out loud as a way for folks to see how the Raven technique works. And I'll be short. Here we go. All right. In the name of Jesus Christ, for Raven technique purposes, the word victory means we forgive every person on the earth for hatred. We forgive every person on the earth for jealousy. We forgive every person on the earth for narcissism. We forgive every person on the earth for impatience. We forgive every person on the earth for war. And we forgive every person on the earth for self-loathing. Until further notice, in the name of Jesus the Christ, it is so. Now I've defined victory in terms of those forgiveness phrases, and now all I do is say the word victory over and over in my mind. Oh, so I say victory, 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 victory. And as I do it, I should feel sensations in my body because my nerves or my nerves and my neural synapses and my stomach brain and my brain are all changing as I say these things. Mm-hmm. For myself and for the other inhabitants of the earth.
That's awesome, Woody. Could you tell people once again how they could find you on the internet one more
time? Yeah. You can find me on the internet at Woodrow Odom Lucas. Just Googling Woodrow Odom Lucas or Googling Woodrow Lucas. Yeah. You can also find me on the internet at YouTube, Woodrow Lucas, Christ Universal Ministries. I've got a lot of videos on there. And then you can also find me on the internet at www.empoweredrecoveryconsulting.com.
Awesome. Woody, thanks for coming on today. Thanks for being here.
Oh, Ed, it's my pleasure. You're such a cool guy, man.
And I really admire you because you've really dealt with a lot of curveballs that were thrown your way, and you really dealt with it with grace and, if I may say so, style.
Wow, style. Tell that to my mom. Tell my mom that, Ed.
We're going to go out here with one more selection by Woody, and it's really awesome. This is Miles Davis, All Blues. Can you tell us what it is about Miles Davis that you wanted to for us to play him today?
You know, Miles Davis was an instant success when he went to New York in the 40s, and he got with Charlie Parker and he started playing. But the thing that I love about Miles Davis is he was always willing to reinvent himself. And he was constantly going to reinvent himself. And, you know, he's worked with different people. He's had different sextets and different quintets. He's always reinventing himself. And All Blues was an album, was off the album with other songs like So What. It was one of those stages in his life where he had to reinvent himself. And he reinvented himself with that cut. And I just think it's so fantastic.
And you've reinvented yourself a few times.
I have.
Yeah. Thank you, Woody. This is Miles Davis. Everyone have a great weekend. Remember, this has just been a show for information. And if you're having any kind of crisis, mental health crisis, please reach out to 988. Call or text. This is Miles.